From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans.
The tale of New Orleans is still a tale of two cities. If you're white, if you're well-connected black, then the recovery is moving full steam ahead. But if you're poor and traditionally disenfranchised or African-American, then it's like the hurricane happened last year.
It's the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. I'm sitting in front of one of the levees that broke. We'll speak with Malik Rahim, the founder of Common Ground Relief. Then we'll talk to the founder of People's Hurricane Relief Fund, a grassroots group fighting for the right of return of the displaced. And when the hurricane struck, another hurricane went through the schools of New Orleans. All the teachers were fired. We'll speak with the former head of the New Orleans Teachers Union. All that and more coming up. But Juan Gonzalez in New York with today's headlines.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. A new congressional report is casting fresh doubt on the Bush administration's claims of progress in Iraq. The Government Accountability Office says the Iraqi government has met just three of the 18 benchmarks set by U.S. lawmakers. Overall violence was found to have remained the same. The Iraqi military showed a decrease in the number of units able to operate without U.S. assistance. A government official says he leaked the report to the Washington Post out of concerns its conclusions would be watered down in final form. The Pentagon has disclosed it won't issue a single unified proposal to President Bush during next month's strategy assessment of the Iraq War. Analysts say the move reflects sharp divides within the military brass on the progress of the U.S. occupation. Military commanders will make separate presentations around the same time, as General David Petraeus appears before Congress. Outgoing Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Peter Pace is reportedly planning on recommending a drawdown of troops in Iraq because of strains on the military. The New York Times is reporting U.S. weapons given to the Iraqi military have ended up in Turkey for use in violent attacks. The Turkish government says serial numbers of weapons seized from Kurdish separatists are the same as those supplied to Iraqi forces. In other Iraq news, the leading Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, has ordered his large group of followers to halt armed operations for up to 6 months. The move comes on the heels of an ongoing gun battle in Karbala between rival Shiite groups. Dozens have been killed, while up to a million have been forced to flee the holy Shiite city. The U.S. military has apologized for arresting eight Iranian nationals in Iraq. The group includes two diplomats. They were seized in Baghdad, handcuffed and blindfolded. The eight were released after Iraqi officials intervened. The group was part of an official delegation in Iraq to discuss electricity cooperation. On Wednesday, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus, called the arrests, quote, regrettable. In Israel and the occupied territories, three Palestinian children were killed Wednesday in an Israeli air attack on Gaza. The Israeli military says it was firing at rocket launchers in the area. The victims were between the ages of 10 and 12. In Greece, thousands of people gathered outside Parliament Wednesday to protest a government response to a massive forest fire. 63 people have been killed in the blaze so far.
We couldn't just sit still and let everything happen without doing anything, without doing anything. We couldn't. We just had to do something to show that we disapprove of this. We couldn't live our life as we used to up to now, because things have changed. This is a big catastrophe that has happened.
It's widely believed many fires in Greece are started by arsonists working on behalf of land developers. In Pakistan, President Pervez Musharraf has reportedly struck a deal with opposition figures that will see him resign as army chief. The move would allow Musharraf to serve another term as president if reelected. In return, the exiled former prime minister, Benazir Bhutto, will return to Pakistan and run for her old post. Bolivia has accused the Bush administration of working to undermine its democratically elected government. On Wednesday, presidential minister Juan Ramón de la Quintana said the White House is not cooperating with Bolivia and instead fostering destabilization.
Queremos decir We want to say in the most respectful, firm, and responsible way that if the United States does not adjust to the policies of the Bolivian government, then the doors are open to leave. We are not going to permit one day more in which this form of cooperation pollutes our democracy, conspires against the right of our people, or offends our national dignity.
Earlier this week, Bolivian Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera accused the U.S. Embassy of financing opposition groups to President Evo Morales. The actor-comedian Jim Carrey has joined a campaign in support of the Burmese pro-democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi. The 1991 Nobel Peace Prize laureate has spent 11 of the past 16 years in jail. She was jailed shortly after her National League for Democracy party won 82% of the vote in a general election.
She's compared to a modern-day Gandhi or Nelson Mandela. Most people in America still don't know about Aung San. And let's face it, the name's a little difficult to remember. Here's how I did it. Aung San sounds like unsung, as in unsung hero. Aung San Suu Kyi is truly an unsung hero.
The Burmese military junta has said to have destroyed more than 3,000 villages and forced over 1 million people to flee their homes. The fate of death row prisoner Kenneth Foster is down to the wire. Foster is scheduled to be killed by lethal injection tonight for a murder the state of Texas admits he didn't commit or plan. 11 years ago, Foster was driving a car with three passengers. One of the passengers left the car, got into an altercation, and shot a man dead. The shooter was executed for this crime last year. Kenneth Foster was 80 feet away in his car during the killing, but he was sentenced to die as well under what's known as Texas's law of parties. The law imposes the death penalty on anybody involved in a crime where a murder occurred. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles has not yet released a decision expected yesterday on whether to grant clemency. A rejection would leave only Foster's final appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Foster's execution would make him the third Texas prisoner executed in as many days. On Thursday, John Joe Amador was executed for a 1994 murder slaying. He maintained his innocence until his death. In immigration news, the AFL-CIO has teamed with the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups to challenge new government rules that would force employers to fire undocumented workers. The new requirements give employers 90 days to fire employees whose Social Security numbers don't match. The group says that would threaten American citizens and undocumented immigrants because of inaccuracies in Social Security Administration records. In Virginia, state Republican lawmakers have introduced legislation that would bar public colleges and universities from accepting undocumented immigrants. The ban would apply even to those who attended public schools and who came to the U.S. at an early age. And a Mexican immigrant rights activist deported earlier this month may be headed back to the United States as a Mexican government envoy. Elvira Arellano has asked Mexican President Felipe Calderón to appoint her a peace and justice ambassador so that she may return with her U.S.-born 8-year-old son. Arellano was deported earlier this month following a year of refuge inside a Chicago church. She was arrested outside a Los Angeles church after arriving to take part in a rally for immigrant rights. And in economic news, a new study shows income disparities in the United States have widened at a staggering rate. Chief executives of large U.S. corporations earned an average $10.8 million last year. CEOs earned more in one day of work than the average employee earned in an entire year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez here in New York with Amy Goodman in New Orleans.
Thanks, Juan. Yes, I'm here in the lower Ninth Ward. Behind me is the industrial canal levee that broke 2 years ago between Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River at 9:38 a.m. local time on Wednesday. A moment of silence was held across New Orleans to mark the moment the levees were breached 2 years ago. Hurricane Katrina flooded about 80% of New Orleans and killed well over 1,600 people, displacing another 1.5 million people from the Gulf Coast. Only two-thirds of the region's population has returned home. Few areas in New Orleans were as hard hit by Hurricane Katrina as the Lower Ninth Ward, where we're broadcasting from today. This predominantly African-American working-class neighborhood remains largely in ruins 2 years later. In a moment, we'll be joined by Malik Rahim, co-founder of the Common Ground Collective, and Alice Craft Kearney of the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic. But first, I want to go back 2 years ago to rebroadcast a part of Malik's first interview on Democracy Now! Just days after Katrina hit New Orleans.
I would have commandeered everything. Greyhound buses, Amtrak trains, school buses, public service buses, and had them all filled with people, getting them out of harm's way. That was the very first thing I would have done. And then second, I would have asked for volunteers. Volunteers are people that live in the community, that know the community, that didn't need a map to find out where such and such a street exists. And had them to come back in here. I would have my police force to commandeer every boat that was available because everybody knew the flooding was gonna happen. You know, to make sure that people would have been getting out. I wouldn't have left it on a faith-based community. I would have made sure that everybody would have had a means, that wanted to leave would have had the means to leave.
That was Malik Rahim speaking days after Hurricane Katrina. A week later, Malik was again on Democracy Now! As he was giving us a tour of the Algiers neighborhood, as our video cameras followed him, Malik showed us how corpses still remained in the street.
Now, his body been here for almost 2 weeks, 2 weeks tomorrow. All right, that this man been laying here. And there's no reason for it. Look where we at. I mean, it's not flooded. There's no reason for them to be and left that body right here like this. I mean, that's just totally disrespect. You know, and I mean, 2 weeks. Every day we ask him about come and pick it up. And they refuse to come and pick it up. And you can see it's literally decomposing right here, right out in the sun. Every day we sit up and we ask them about it. Because, I mean, this is closest you could get to tropical climate in America. And they won't do anything with it.
Malik, do you know who this person is?
No. But regardless of who it is, I wouldn't care if it's Saddam Hussein or bin Laden. Nobody deserves to be left here. And the kids pass by here and they're seeing it. I mean, the elderly, this is what frightened a lot of people into leaving. We don't know if he's a victim of vigilantes or what, but that's all we know is that his body had been allowed to remain out here for over 2 weeks.
Well, Malik Rahim joins us again today as we broadcast from the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. He's a longtime community activist in New Orleans and co-founder of the Common Ground Collective. We're also joined by Alice Craft Kearney of the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!, though it's odd to welcome you both to your own neighborhood as we come in from New York. But Malik, let's begin with you. Set the scene for us. I mean, outside the view of our camera, of our microphones right here, when we were down here 2 years ago, there were a lot of destroyed houses. Right now, it's mainly nature taking over. We don't even see the foundations of the houses.
No, most of the houses that wasn't destroyed during Katrina was demolished under our city's Good Neighbors program. So what you have is just a series of empty lots, and it's a testimony of the lack of recovery. This is a testimony of a lack of truly support by our federal, state, and local government for the upliftment of this community. You find other areas of the Lower Ninth Ward that have a large population of whites, the Holy Cross area, and it's doing well. But over here, you only have, I know of only one house that have been totally rebuilt.
Who determines what gets built, what doesn't?
Funds. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln. You know, they make the determination. Hamilton, those are the ones who make the determination. If you don't have the money, if you don't have the strength to rebuild, then you are just in a dismal situation.
What is this Road Home Fund?
You know what? When you find out, Amy, you ask me, the only thing I could say is it's funding for those who are well-connected. You know, because those who haven't, who don't have the connections, they haven't seen nothing but promises from Road Home.
Tell us what happened 2 years ago here, just behind us. There is the levee.
Well, three blocks. Well, the levee is broke. I believe it was because of the fact of the Mississippi River Gulf outlet, which is just about 2 miles away from here. And when it pushed that storm surge through that canal, it came through and it broke the levee here at the Industrial Canal. And a barge came through, and that barge traveled about 3.5 blocks, just crushing houses. You know, this is an area that had the highest debt toll in the entire city. Somewhere between 300 to 500 people lost their lives right here. A good friend of mine's now, he lost his mother and his granddaughter, you know, the morning of the 29th. So you have many people here that have really suffered that pain. And there wasn't no trauma counselors here. You know, you have people that after going through this, after witnessing and experiencing the worst disaster to hit America, they have yet to have any type of counseling. And then they have yet to have any type of support in rebuilding their lives. So you see the area where the people was hardest hit 2 years ago by a hurricane. Now, 2 years later, they're still being the hardest hit by another hurricane. But this hurricane is called racism, greed, and corruption.
Where are the people who had homes here who didn't die?
They're displaced all over. We have a mailing list of roughly around 700 of the residents in this area. And they're all over America. I mean, they're all over America. We have some as far as Seattle, Washington, Miami. We have met some in New York, you know, from this area that's now living in New Jersey, at least in New Jersey, you know, but they're displaced all over America.
As we talk about recovery efforts, I want to play a clip of what President Bush told the country on September 15th, 2005, when he visited New Orleans.
And tonight, I also offer this pledge of the American people. Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives. And all who question the future of the Crescent City need to know. There is no way to imagine America without New Orleans. And this great city will rise again.
This great city. That was President Bush. He was speaking, I believe it was Jackson Square, where there was a candlelight vigil last night. The generators were put on for the first time. He was flooded, bathed in light for that speech. And then the generators were turned off and they didn't see electricity for a long time. Malik.
Well, you know, anything that he said about Jackson Square, at Jackson Square, he was speaking toward the residents in that area, you know, and he have helped them. You know, they are recovered. The French Quarters is doing well. The New Orleans Saints is doing well. You know, the Garden District is doing well. I'm talking about the Ninth Ward. I'm talking about this area of the lower Ninth Ward. I'm talking about New Orleans East, where he wouldn't even put a blue tarp on the roofs of these houses, where they put blue tarps on, sea of blue tarps on every other community. Here, nobody received anything. And 2 years later, nobody is receiving anything.
Alice Craft Kearney, you founded the health clinic that's here in the lower Ninth Ward. You also lost your home.
Yes, I did.
Where did you live?
My home was in eastern New Orleans, and I received 5.5 feet of water in my home.
Where were you that day?
Actually, I was here in the lower Ninth Ward in my brother's home. He has a three-story historic home in the Holy Cross area.
Is his home okay?
Well, he has decided to rebuild, and he has completed that reconstruction, and he and his wife are living in their home now.
And your home destroyed?
My home, through the efforts of friends, brothers and sisters who saw my plight, they came down and they started working on my home, and it's about 80% complete, enough for me to move into.
Were you able to get road home funds?
Not as of yet. I'm waiting to see what will happen. But you have to understand, road home appeared to be a program that was set up to fail. And many of the folks who did receive the road home money, really, that was not their intended target. The folks who were supposed to receive the money were supposed to be people who were flooded. Our state started giving money to people who had wind damage, and that was not the true intention. So those folks received money over folks who were actually flooded. So there's a problem there.
I saw Cynthia McKinney yesterday, the former congresswoman from Georgia. She was up protesting at Kennebunkport and then drove her way down here to be here for the second anniversary. And I asked her what she thought of President Bush coming here, and she said, did he bring money? She said, that's all that counted.
Exactly.
The clinic, tell us about it.
Well, my friend Patricia Berryhill, who's been with me the entire time, she and I decided, once we started the clinic. Now, I must tell you that Common Ground Relief, this is a project of Common Ground Relief, the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic, because Michelle Shin, who was a organizer down here in the Lower Ninth Ward, along with Leaders Creating Change Through Contribution, were able to come up with a plan for us to assist us to get this clinic up and running. Once we got the idea of a clinic, we needed people to run it who had medical experience, and then they turned to residents, and that was myself and Patricia Berryhill. This clinic was formed because there was a need. There was no primary health care here in the Lower Ninth Ward.
You're a nurse.
Yes, I'm a registered nurse, and my friend Patricia Berryhill is a registered nurse whose master's prepared with over 32 years' experience. And we have dealt with this population before because we were both working at the Medical Center of Louisiana, Charity Hospital, and she was at the other campus, University.
Charity's closed.
And Charity is closed.
Isn't Charity where they had a ceremony yesterday, setting up a mausoleum for 100 identified remains?
That's correct. But Charity was the safety net provider for the medically indigent patients in the community. And with that being destroyed, with that infrastructure being destroyed, we knew that many people were going to be caught with, the uninsured were going to be caught without any type of medical care. We saw people really just dying on both sides of the street just because they didn't have access to medical care. And we decided we weren't going to wait. We saw people dying at Convention Center Boulevard, the Superdome, just waiting for the bus, and we decided we weren't going to wait for the healthcare bus. So we determined we were going to open this clinic. And the clinic was opened by people giving their time, their talent, and what happened was we had folks from all over the country who came to renovate the building, and we had supplies, medical supplies, and equipment that were sent down to us. Contributions from folks like yourself, as well as some foundations that got us started. And so that's how the clinic actually started and opened.
What do you need now?
Right now, we need money for operating funds. You are dealing with a scarcity of healthcare professionals because just like my family left the region, many of the healthcare providers left the region.
Did I see a figure something like 90% of doctors gone?
I'm not going to say 90%, but there was a large number that actually left, never to come back again. And we're not just talking about doctors. We're talking about nurses, nurse practitioners, physical therapists, pharmacists, anybody in the healthcare field. All of these folks are gone, and many of them are not going to return. So that leaves us here with a few healthcare professionals, and they can basically name their salary. So we're competing against hospitals with wonderful fringe benefit packages, sign-on bonuses, and it's very difficult at this point. So we need funds so that we can actually attract good people to the clinic.
Malik Rahim, as we wrap up this segment, we're standing in front of, sitting in front of Common Ground Relief, and there are all different signs. One says, tourist, shame on you. Drive by without stopping, paying to see my pain. 1,600 plus died here. And another says, wish list, men's clothing, food items, cleaning supplies, baby supplies. How do you keep going here?
Basically, off of generosity of grassroots people.
What about the city?
2 years later, we have served 170,000 people in direct services, and we have yet to even be visited by any elected official. So we don't receive no federal, state, or local support.
I spoke to Mayor Ray Nagin yesterday. He had dinner with President Bush the night before. I asked him what his demands were, and he said it wasn't a time for demands.
Well, you know, if your home is rebuilt, if you're living well, if you're full, then maybe it wasn't the time. But if you're hungry, if you're homeless, if you have been traditionally disenfranchised, then the time have always been there. You know.
You travel not only around the country, around the world now. What is the message that you are spreading?
Well, the one that I'm spreading most is the fact that we had vigilantes in this city that have killed young African-American males, I mean, with complete immunity. One equated killing young males equated it with pheasant season, shooting pheasants in South Dakota, and nothing is done. That person who body that I showed you in Algiers, who was killed by vigilantes, his body wasn't identified. He's one of those 100. Well, these are the things that we are spreading, the injustice that exists here, that Jefferson Parish refused to open up his border to African-American, that there's two forms of America. There's an America that's for the white and the rich, and then there's another America for the poor, the minorities, the disenfranchised, and that has to change. So what we're trying to promote now is that we have to come together, that New Orleans is a testing ground for this nation, that if we fail this test on bringing democracy and justice to New Orleans, then this country is doomed.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Malik Rahim is founder of Common Ground Relief. We're sitting in front of Common Ground Relief, and behind that, the levee that was breached 2 years ago. Alice Craft Kearney is executive director of the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic, her home also devastated in East New Orleans. I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll be back with People's Hurricane Relief Fund. Stay with us.
Thanks. All right.
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear, the future was coming, and now it's here. They had to fix the levees, 'cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding, just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said, now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted, inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, 'cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. thousand years of warning. No evacuation plan. It was just that the waters froze. Get out if you can. There were no buses. No one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water. They died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Now the city is in ruins, a massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. A million refugees, here we are, in the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth, where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end.
That was David Rovick singing New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and that's where we're broadcasting from today. From New Orleans, specifically from the lower Ninth Ward. Behind me, the Industrial Canal levee that breached 2 years ago today. A five-day international tribunal on hurricanes Katrina and Rita opened last night here in New Orleans. The tribunal is bringing together hurricane survivors, international delegations, expert witnesses, a team of human rights and civil rights prosecutors, and a panel of U.S.-based and international judges. One survivor of the hurricane, Viola Washington, said, "We are calling for an international tribunal to bring charges of racial discrimination, forced eviction of public housing residents, violations of the right to life and health, and the denial of the right to return." We're joined right now by two people from here in New Orleans, founders of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, one of the main sponsors of the tribunal. Kali Akuno is executive director of People's Hurricane Relief Fund, and Malcolm Suber is the group's national organizing coordinator. Before we talk about the tribunal, I wanted to go to something that happened earlier in the day yesterday. It was outside the convention center. A number of people gathered. Remember the convention center? That was the place, Michael Brown said, they didn't realize the difference between the Superdome and the convention center, that people were also in the convention center, without water, without food, without help. But a number of people spoke, and among them was Malcolm of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund. You gave a fiery speech, Malcolm, and you particularly focused on the Red Cross. Why?
We believe that the Red Cross has basically stolen money from the victims here in New Orleans. They collected, by their own accounting, $2.1 billion. They claim that they spent $1.9 billion and they had $200 million left. But we have never had any public accounting of the funds actually spent. And this last $200 million, they have decided to establish a means to recovery program, which works through a case management system. And basically, the only people who knew about the program were their partners, the other nonprofits, and they would give the money to selective survivors. And we just don't believe that that's a very fair and democratic way. We don't think that the donors who gave the money to the Red Cross intended that the money be set aside and decided by the Red Cross what to do with the money. And so we have just been challenging their veracity on this whole program. And witness to that is every time we've confronted them, they've changed the figures. When we first started this campaign, they said they had $80 million left. A week later, they said they had $40 million left. And then the national president came down here, he said that they had $171 million left. So you don't know what the story really is, so they haven't gotten the story together. And of course, they've been attacking the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, saying that we are spreading lies and stuff against them. But we confronted them directly, and we took their application to the local news media, and they were forced to admit that the program existed, because when people first called about the program, the Red Cross would say, what are you talking about? We've never heard of a Means to Recovery program. So we want to know why such secrecy, and why did you decide that it was up to you, the Red Cross, to decide what to do? The other important factor is they got $50 million from Kuwait, and instead of giving that money to people, they built new office buildings in New York City.
$50 million from, did you say Kuwait?
Kuwait, yes. That was part of the international aid given to the Red Cross on behalf of disaster victims, and they decided to take the money and build new office buildings. And we think that's thievery.
Let's talk about the People's Tribunal and what you're doing with this, Callie.
Well, today will be the first day of testimony. And we're going to have 2 days of testimony, 1 day of deliberation, and 1 day of going through a site tour throughout the city of New Orleans.
Who is deliberating?
Deliberating today, we have, it's broken down into several different areas, Amy, to really try to cover the expansion of all the different things that took place. So we're starting off with the issue of police brutality and prisoners' rights, really highlighting the torture and abuse that took place, and the abandonment which took place, and the different human rights violations that it brings up. We're also going to be dealing with some of the summary killings and executions which took place, you know, shortly after the flood. That's what begins us off. And then later on this afternoon, we're going to be looking at the whole historical development and neglect around the levees, particularly, you know, this levee here with the bars that broke, and highlighting the systematic nature of how the government knew that its design was faulty. It had depleted the fund systematically since Hurricane Betsy. They knew categorically it would not withstand a Category 1 or 2 hurricane, and yet they just left it in total state of disrepair. And they have to be held accountable for that. Those are the things we're going to focus on. And then from there, really breaking down a systematic way later on this afternoon of how women's rights have been violated through this in particular process. And one of the things I think everyone so vividly remembers about the experience and what people saw, CNN and all the news cameras, was the number of just black women, single black women, who were just kind of left stranded by the city not having, or the government not having, a systematic evacuation plan, not having buses, not having public transportation, not giving effective evacuation orders. Those are the things we're really going to highlight and then ask critical questions. You know, that we're looking for a response to, some of which we know the answer, some of which the answers have not necessarily been sufficiently provided. But, you know, we're going to cover different things like Blanco giving shoot-to-kill orders. Under whose authority? Why was that order given?
What do you mean, shoot-to-kill?
When she was, I think it was September 3rd, or September 2nd, she gave orders that for the National Guard and other folks that they were trained. They just came back from Iraq. They knew how to use their weapons, and if they caught anybody so-called looting, that they had the right to shoot to kill. You know, and there was no question around, well, if people don't have water, people don't have food, the government is not providing this, how are people other supposed to fend for themselves? And it didn't really address that question, you know, just kind of left it open. And so under what authority does she have to issue an order like that? And then why was it necessary to bring in so many different contractors or mercenary forces that came in? Under whose authority were they under? What rules were they operating by? And we've heard a number of different reports and accounts.
You mean companies like Blackwater?
Like Blackwater, who are still here operating. Black Hawk and a number of different security companies. What were they doing here? That needs to be fully exposed. We know, and what had come out today through some of the deliberations, that they didn't get their contracts approved. right? Many of these companies, they were just kind of operating without proper licensing. So for the different acts that they committed, similar to Iraq, who are they accountable to, right? This all really needs to be exposed, brought out. And, you know, with all the different information and the crimes that are being alleged and are going to be demonstrated and proved throughout this process, you know, what we're demanding is justice and reparations.
So you're having this tribunal of a number of days. Will city officials be here, there?
They've been invited. State officials have been invited from Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And Bush and the heads of FEMA have been invited.
This all comes out of the first Survivors Assembly.
That's right.
What was that?
That's right. The first Survivors Assembly was the first major national gathering of survivors after they'd been displaced. It was in December 2005 in Jackson, Mississippi. And it was basically a democratic forum where all those who were displaced could come together and organize themselves and make some comprehensive demands in a program to carry their action forward. So the tribunal is just one of the programmatic things that came out of that assembly. And we're having the second Survivors Assembly here in New Orleans in December 8th and 9th.
Can you talk, Malcolm, about the issue of homelessness and the issue of the destruction of housing?
Yes. Because of the great destruction of the flood, that 140,000 units of housing were destroyed. The other problem, of course, is that there has not been an aggressive program on the part of state or local government to repair homes or get money to the victims so that they can repair their homes. Nor has there been any real effort to provide temporary housing, to construct dormitories and what have you for people to live. As a consequence, the number of homeless in the city has grown from 6,000 before the storm to 12,000 now. And one of the characteristics of the new homeless are these were people in the city who had homes before the storm. And of course, coupled with the fact that rents have doubled and tripled, poor working class black folk in the city can't afford to pay the rents that they are charging today. And so because of that crisis, we have been organizing the homeless, and they now have an encampment at Duncan Plaza right across from City Hall, actually putting the question of homelessness in the face of the politicians and saying to them that we must make a pledge to outlaw homelessness in the New Orleans. And the way that we have to do that, of course, is we have to ask the city to take control of all these abandoned buildings, all these abandoned homes, get a reconstruction program going, whether you're hiring homeless folks, youth, to bring them back home and get them to work rebuilding the city. And not only will they be rebuilding it, but they will be investing in the city, which they know and love, but they will be making a contribution to its redevelopment.
I asked Mayor Nagin yesterday about public housing and why most of the public housing has not been reopened, although a lot is in good shape, like Lafitte housing.
Right.
What is your response to that?
That's part of the gentrification and ethnic cleansing policy, which was being pursued prior to. As you know, two of the developments are right downtown, Lafitte and Iberville. The developers have always had their eye on that as an extension of the French Quarter, essentially from the French Quarter straight back to the lake.
Iberville is the birthplace of jazz.
Right. And so, you know, this is just part of that whole gentrification program and the changing of the demographics of the city. The local white ruling class wants to maintain its, to regain its political control. And so they have used this storm and the flooding as a convenient excuse to get rid of black folk, especially poor black people. And basically, their mentality is you can only come back to this plantation if you've got a job. If you don't have a job, we don't want to provide any social services.
We just have a minute, but this whole issue of the right of return, how are you framing it?
It's an unequivocal human right, and it has to entail a comprehensive program for both reconstruction, returning folks home with jobs, justice, and equity. I mean, those are the basic parts of it.
About 60% of people have returned home?
I would say that that number is actually inaccurate. I mean, I think it's still closer to between 45 and 50. I think if you look around the region, you may find that number of people living in Slidell, people living in Baton Rouge. But I still think, you know, realistically, when the sun goes down, still only half the population of New Orleans in town.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Is there contact information for, well, today in New Orleans, the tribunal is at People's, at the Pan American building?
It's at the Pan American Conference Center, which is on Poydras and Camp Streets in downtown New Orleans. If you want to get in contact with us, you can call us at 504-301-0215, or you can visit our website, which is www.peopleshurricane.org.
Well, Kali Akuno and Malcolm Suber, thanks so much. People's Hurricane Relief Fund. We're broadcasting from here in New Orleans in the Lower Ninth Ward. When we come back, we'll speak with the former head of the New Orleans Teachers Union. After the hurricane, all of the teachers in New Orleans were fired. Stay with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kid Jordan, the song is Forever. He's a New Orleans artist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR radio stations, low-power community and college radio stations, public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish at our website. I'm Amy Goodman. We're here in the Lower Ninth Ward, just outside the Industrial Canal levee that was breached 2 years ago. The hurricane hit 2005, August 29th. And what happened, the devastation, people talk about a natural disaster and an unnatural disaster. While many in New Orleans have waited 2 years for recovery, the restructuring of its schools seems to happen overnight. Not long after Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans, the Louisiana legislature cleared the way for the state to assume control of 107 out of 128 schools in the New Orleans district. Immediately, the state began converting many of its newly acquired schools to charter schools, publicly funded schools run for, well, by for-profit or nonprofit groups that operate by a charter or contract. One result is that the number of unionized teachers dropped from about 4,700 to 500. Nat LaCour is the secretary-treasurer of the American Federation of Teachers. He's the former president of the United Teachers of New Orleans. He joins us now here in New Orleans, came for the anniversary observances yesterday, is flying back to Washington today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nat LaCour.
Thank you for inviting me.
How is it for you to be here in the Lower Ninth Ward?
It's really depressing. Obviously, we are dissatisfied with the rate of progress in rebuilding the city. And, of course, the Lower Ninth Ward was the hardest hit.
Talk about the situation with the teachers. I don't think most people in this country understand the hurricane that swept through the schools after the natural hurricane.
Well, that is correct. It's not Katrina that did the damage. It's many of the elected officials in this state and in this local community that, on the heels of the storm, they terminated almost all of the school employees. And so it wasn't just teachers, paraprofessionals, cooks, bus drivers, principals. They fired 7,500 people. Now, the tragedy—
They fired everyone?
Yes. The tragedy of that is that many of these individuals had been impacted by the storm, lost their property, only to discover that they were people who were conspiring to take their jobs. And when you took their job, you also took their insurance. Even for the people who were retired and was participating in a local health care plan, the premiums went up so much, they tripled, that many people had to drop their insurance even if they were staying here. So you had a really bad situation, not well thought out, but people attempting to seize the opportunity to create charter schools and to take control of the school system. Now, that was bad for the adults. But the second tragedy here is when you have young people, school-age children, particularly elementary students, who experience a tragedy in their life, and certainly Katrina was one. What all the professionals will say to you is that the first thing that you need to do is to get those children back in a normal setting as much as possible. That would mean returning these kids, opening the schools, so that they could be with their schoolmates and the teachers and the staff that they have come to know. Instead, the schools were closed for the people who wanted to come back or for the people that were here in order to accommodate this experiment with, I would call it, control. Many of the schools that open as charter schools have selected admission policies, which mean that they get to determine which students will attend and which students will not. And so what you have here, if the population is not careful, you set up an elitist-type school system, and we need to avoid that.
You know, yesterday at the tribunal, there were these T-shirts that said, "Don't believe the hype. The recovery is not, quote, slow. This is an experiment in privatization of an entire city."
Yes. I agree with that, but I think it's a serious mistake. The things that they have done under the guise of attempting to improve the schools, they could have done that, working with the traditional public schools, but they chose not to.
So you have the, quote, recovery schools, named so even before Hurricane Katrina. These are the big public schools. One of the schools, the John Mack, the John McDonough School, something like 35 security, 23 teachers, 86 kids expelled, 84 kids graduate. I think that was the statistics in the Nation piece on this. One of the students saying, "When I come to school, I feel like I'm going to visit someone in prison."
Well, I only know what I've read and heard. Obviously, I talked to the teachers in the union here, and so I know a little bit about John Mack, but nothing firsthand. Let me simply say this. I don't think there's anybody in New Orleans who would say that they were satisfied with the school system prior to Katrina, because there's an effort to say that there are people here who want the status quo. That is not true. What we want are efforts on the part of school officials and elected officials to improve the schools. And we maintain that a lot of the attention and the focus that have been given should have been given to reopening the schools. You had a reduced student population, so you could have kept your teachers, reduced class size, which is one of the major factors in getting students to do better. But they chose not to do that. And we just think that it's a real danger. Now, things may work out. Our union is still around. When you said 500, we didn't have 500 because everybody lost their job. And as of yesterday, we had 1,200 members because people understand that there's a need to join in a manner in which they can collectively impact decision-making, and that is what is needed. We've had a union in this city since 1937. We were one of the first communities in the Deep South to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement. It is not the union contract or the teachers that were the problem. It's a lack of resources. And that continues to be the situation. And it doesn't matter whether the schools are run by the state or the local school board. If you don't put in sufficient resources, if you don't give the teachers the wherewithal that they need to provide quality education, then you are not going to do a good job of reaching all of your students, but particularly your disadvantaged students. And so we're interested in all students, not some students. When they opened the schools here and made some of the schools charter schools, they took their best schools and made them charter schools. And so obviously these schools opened, there were places for the kids who were doing well to get back to a rather normal setting. The other parents and kids have had to fish, go around and find places. Kids have been turned down. I'm sure that they will do a better job. But all of the so-called problems that we're experiencing now was not necessary. Our union is committed to work with school officials and elected people to rebuild the school system, to make it better. It can be done, but we have to work together as a team, not one group of people attempting to just force upon the community what they think is right or the best way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Nat LaCour. He is the Secretary-Treasurer of the American Federation of Teachers. He's the former president of the Union of Teachers here in New Orleans. We're going to be here for another day on the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and the breaching of the levees. And we look forward to hearing your questions as well to put to our guests. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the Lower Ninth Ward, just in front of the Industrial Canal levee that was breached, just in front of Common Ground Relief, where thousands have come from not only around the country, but around the world to help rebuild homes, to help people here who are suffering. I want to thank the whole team that made this broadcast possible. I want to thank Anjali Kamat and David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan and all the team in New York, Shrifa Bokadus and Mike Burke and Anjali Kamat, as well as Elizabeth Press and Becca Staley, Carrie Mache. I want to thank the New Orleans crew, John George and Mark Moore and Brian McCann and Scott Larman, Janice Thomason, Don Lagarde, Jess Crawford as well. Our website is democracynow.org. You can watch the broadcast there. You can listen to it. You can read the transcripts. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.